It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen. Welcome you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio. Carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com, www.johnmack13.com. At the same site are links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. Upcoming episodes of this show will include authors, poets, editors, judges, technologists, pundits, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will too. My new 15-minute story and opinion shows, John Mack's Radio Rants, may also be accessed by going to the website, once again, www.johnmack13.com, and clicking the John Mack Radio Rants for next shows. Unlike this show's, the new show has no regular schedule and is produced sporadically. My guest next week on this show is technology pundit, angel investor, and cosmonaut Esther Dyson. Tune in and listen. Tonight is technology pioneer and journalist David Bunnell. I've known of David for years. I wrote for the magazine, PC Magazine, but I didn't know him personally until my editor and some computer shopper and close friend Stan Veit and I had embarked on the monthly web magazine. And David, also a friend of Stan's, offered to join our startup. Unfortunately, our collaboration was short-lived. Stan died soon thereafter and we ceased publication. I did, however, interview David not long after for a feature that I did for Techopedia on him and at Roberts. David's career in the computer field goes all the way back to the first working consumer microcomputer, the Altair. We'll explore his life in depth tonight on the John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, David, and welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? Nice to be here.
I am wonderful hearing your voice. Let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Nebraska in a little town called Alliance. And I went to school, Alliance High School, and then the University of Nebraska in Lincoln.
You told me a few weeks ago about how a Nebraska youth became a New York Yankee fan. Please share that story with our audience.
Sure. I was a small, well, 1956, I guess I was about 9 years old, and my dad and I were up on the roof of our house, and he was putting in new shingles. And we had the radio on, and it was very loud, and it was a baseball game. And it was during the World Series, and batter after batter came up for the Dodgers, and no one could seem to get a hit. No one got on base, and Don Larsen was pitching. And my dad got very excited, and I could hear the excitement in the crowd. And he explained to me the concept of a no-hitter, and even beyond that, the concept of a perfect game. And it turned out Don Larsen was a Yankee pitcher, pitched the only perfect game in the World Series, and which meant that not a single Dodger made it to first base, not even by a walk or an error, much less a hit. And so I became an instant Yankee fan from that point on. And I think also that was reinforced by the fact that the Yankees were on TV and on the radio more often than other teams. And in the early days of TV, we only had two channels. So it's not like the day where you could choose between, several different ball games, or decide you follow almost any team you wanted. And the Yankees were well liked and hated both, and so they were on TV more than other teams, and it was great fun to follow them.
Was that?
And
was
I
that
still
the game
do.
Was that the game of the week, the Dizzy Dean? On
You know, I very well, it could have been, but at that age, I did not know who Dizzy Dean was yet.
I know that you are both a track champion and the sports editor of your father's paper at a young age. Tell us about your sports accomplishment, and how old were you when you started writing?
Well, I played tennis, and I was on the cross-country team, played basketball, and my dad was the editor of the newspaper, so I started working there first as a newspaper boy, and then gradually I started writing the classified ads, and then after that I became a reporter for the local, kind of local news, court reporter, and finally sports editor. By the time I was in high school, in addition to all the things I did as a student and as an athlete, I was the sports editor for the Lions Daily Times Herald, which was a daily newspaper. And so I went to the newspaper office at 5:30 every morning with my father, and I put out the sports page, mostly by was wire copy, which came in on a teletype. And I wrote the headlines and picked the stories and dummied up the page, what it would look like. And then I wrote the articles and took photographs for the basketball games and baseball in the summer, football. And so I has a very, had a very active life and really loved the world of the newspaper. In those days, it was very noisy. Everything was clang, 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 from the typewriters to the linotype machines, people yelling over the noise at each other, you know, to, you know, just a lot of excitement just in the atmosphere. Whereas you go into any kind of newspaper office today and it's just very quiet, and you know, you just don't have that ambience.
Is the paper still in business?
Yeah, still there. It's, I was back there recently, and I noticed that the paper is in, they have a four-color press now, so it's in color, not just black and white. And they redesigned it. It looks very nice. It's kind of, it's, if you live there, it's an essential part of life because it's the only place you can go to understand and find out what's going on a local scene. So it plays a role, and it survives, which is kind of amazing because a lot of, you know, newspapers have had a hard time.
Most of the papers like that in my area have been taken over by Gannett.
It's not, but it's a small chain of papers in that area. The Kansas City Star, I think, is part of the same, probably the largest paper in that group. But the little town has seen, whereas just most towns in the Midwest, in Nebraska, South Dakota, have really declined. They're becoming virtual ghost towns, and you go to them, and the storefronts are empty. You see empty houses. You see abandoned school buildings. You see everything in kind of disrepair, and you can tell people are poor, and that that world has changed because the people have moved, and the small farms are gone, and it's a really almost depressing. But in my hometown, Alliance is booming because it's a railroad hub, and every day about 50-100 car trains go through Alliance. They're coal. So there's hundreds and hundreds of tons of coal goes through Alliance every day, coming from Wyoming, the Powder River area, where is the largest coal mining in the United States. Some very high percentage of all the electricity in the United States is generated from coal that's burned from that coal mine. And so the railroad train comes through Alliance and it goes all the way down to this big electric plants in Tennessee and Georgia that are responsible for most of the pollution we have, more so than automobiles. So it's a mixed blessing that the little town is booming and there's all these railroaders living there and they have good jobs, they make money. And so that it's a kind of an exception for that part of the world as a town that's kind of booming.
That's interesting because
I think
the most people in the country, or at least the East Coast, think of West Virginia and Kentucky as the coal mine centers of the United States. Obviously, they're not.
No, it's not anymore. This is where the coal from Wyoming burns cleaner than other places, and these are massive strip mines. It's a huge operation, and there's just an unbelievable amount. And there's enough coal there to keep doing it for another 100 years.
Wow. Do you know the current owners of the paper, and they know you as one of the people who was involved years ago with it?
Well, they know who I am because my dad became really well known. He worked on the newspaper for 40 years. He started there just before World War II, and he came back. And he was sort of the town historian, and he was highly regarded. And so he's still very respected. He's not alive anymore, but people knew him. So if I called up the newspaper office and say, "I'm David Bunnell," and they say, "Oh, you're Hughes' boy."
which is your middle name too, right?
Yeah, it's my middle name.
What'd you major in?
I learned everything I know about journalism. I learned from him. I never took a journalism class or studied it in school. It was all firsthand experience.
So then you didn't major in journalism in college. What did you major in?
I majored in history, and my last couple years in college, I switched to teacher's college just so I could get a teaching certificate and could be a teacher. So I did that. I moved to Chicago. I taught for 2 years in inner city schools in Chicago. And then I spent 2 years on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota as a teacher. The first year I was a teacher, I got fired. And the second year I just sort of hung out, and that was during the year that Wounded Knee happened. I went to Wounded Knee. I knew Russell Means and Dennis Banks, and I brought food and supplies to the militants in Wounded Knee and wrote
articles
about it.
Well, you had been involved during college at the STS also, weren't you?
Yeah, I was really a rebel, I guess, but not, it was pretty typical. The Vietnam War seemed so unjust, and then there was the riots in the city and the civil rights movement. When I was in college, I actually met some freedom riders who were at Nebraska. They were graduate students or professors, who had actually gone on freedom rides. And the University of Nebraska, in spite of the fact that Nebraska is sort of a very all-white, Republican state, but the university was very multicultural, and there were students there from all over the world, and it was a great place to be exposed to different ways of thinking. I met Allen Ginsberg at the University of Nebraska, for example. So he had a pretty different way of looking at things.
That's a connection.
And Dick Gregory, I met him too. Yeah.
My guest last week, Susan Brown Millett, who's best known for her feminist writing, but she had been in Meridian, Mississippi in 64, year that these three were killed. And
right.
A while back, I had a poet on who had been the student of Ginsberg in college and said he was a great teacher.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, he was an amazing man. So
So what did you do with the SDS? How long were you involved with the SDS?
Well, that was I joined, and for a while I was president of it. It was a small group in Nebraska because, you know, we weren't at the center of things the way Columbia University was. And we tried to get ROTC thrown off campus, ROTC. And my proudest moment was leading a movement there to put an end to discrimination on off-campus student housing. That there were places, apartments that you could rent in Lincoln if you were a student, but they wouldn't rent to an African or to a Black or to Indian. They only would rent to, you know, white students. And so we organized. I worked with, there was a Black Student Union, and then there's SDS and some other groups. We formed a coalition, and we marched into the administration building, each of us with a brick in our hands. And we sat down in the hallways, and we sat there until they agreed to talk to us. And they caved in right away, and they passed a new rule that said off-campus housing was could not be approved if they discriminated. So you could live off campus, but only in approved housing. And from that point on, that housing had to be non-discriminatory. So that was an accomplishment that I had a part in.
I know that
we weren't very effective in kicking ROTC off campus.
I know that the great Bob Gibson, the baseball, came out of Omaha to Creighton, so parts of Nebraska must have been non-discriminatory at that time.
Yeah, there's always exceptions and stuff. Eldridge Cleaver ran for president in 1968, and he campaigned in Omaha, and I remember going to his rally there. Then Bobby Kennedy came to Lincoln, and that was quite exciting. I love Bobby Kennedy. I still do.
That was a very strange time. The Cleaver was his books, Salt on Ice, was extremely eloquent.
Oh yeah.
Then when he was indicted, he fled to Algeria, and right. Then whatever happened after that, the indictment seemed to go away, and he came back to the United States, and he became
back,
an entrepreneur.
Yeah, yeah, he designed designer pants. You might remember those.
I do. They had a special space for the male organ. It never really took off. And
they sure did.
And Bobby Seale went from being indicted to writing cookbooks.
So times
changed.
It was pretty wonderful. I did when I was in Chicago as a teacher, the Black Panthers were there, and it was the time when the police raided their house and killed a bunch of them.
Fred
that
Hampton.
Was only a few blocks away from Fred Hampton and Clark. I forget his first name, but they were. Close to the school where I was teaching. The school I was teaching was a middle school, which is like junior high school. And the very next day, the kids threw all the books out the window. They
rioted. If you remember during that convention, supposedly, it seemed that Mayor Daley was actually calling Abe Ribicoff on the stage a Jew bastard or something, and I thought that was just awful.
The whole thing was he was incredible, terrible and amazing at the same time.
Right. Yeah.
The teachers went on strike when I was teaching in Chicago. We'd been on strike for about a month, and he got tired of it, so he called in the head of the teachers union and the head of the school board. And they met in his office, and about a half hour later, they came out and announced the settlement. We went back to work. I mean, that he really did have a lot of power in that town. He could pull the strings, and God knows what he said to them. But
this sounds like
And they basically settled for they gave us a raise that kind of made up for the money we lost while we were out on strike.
It sounds like the image that we had of both him and of Lyndon Johnson, and you had the impression that if there was a tad more of Johnson in our present president, he would have locked some of these people in a room and said, "Call me when you have a settlement," and we would have had a bit more.
Oh, Johnson would have. I believe Johnson would have been our greatest president if it weren't for the Vietnam War. If he hadn't gotten sucked into that and put into, you know, a position, he could see no way out of it. And unfortunately, because otherwise he is the most accomplished president we've had.
I think that's a big if, though.
It's a big if. And, you know, it's too bad. But he was vilified, and you know, I was certainly among those who vilified him. And when he announced that he wasn't going to seek a renomination, you know, I was jumping up and down cheering with my colleagues. So you know, we were happy to see him go, but then we got Nixon.
right. Tell us about your experience on the reservation, working with the Indian Affairs, and why'd you get fired?
I worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs as an official, like, teacher at a small school in a town called Kyle, which is near Pine Ridge. And during that year, for the first time, the community was allowed to have an actual school board, and instead of just being dictated to by the agency. And so the school board met, and the first thing they did was fire the principal. And the principal of that school was a complete racist, and he was horrible. He, you know, belittled the Indian men. Boys, if they had long hair, he made fun of their culture. He discouraged the Indians people from coming to the area where their teacher housing was. He stole food from the cafeteria. He would order steaks for the cafeteria and keep them for himself. He did a lot of corrupt things, and so. The other teachers there largely supported him because they were equally corrupt, and they were threatening to quit. So I stood up and said, "Well, I'll stay." And my wife was a teacher, and she'll stay. And we have all these friends in Chicago who teach, and they'll come out here, and they'll teach, and they'll volunteer to teach, and we'll keep the school going. So if you all want to leave, you know, good riddance. And so actually the principal was forced out. And he left, and the other teachers ended up calming down, and they stayed. And they brought in a new principal, and at the end of the year, when after the last, you know, the last day of school, I was called into the new principal's office and fired. Lesson in life. And, you know, they made up a bunch of reasons, but I knew the real reason.
So how did you get to hang around, though? How'd you get to
wife was a teacher, and she got a job teaching at another little town called Wombly, which was not far away. And so we moved there, and she taught that year, and I stayed home and took care of our young daughter and did some writing. And that's why I was free to go to Wounded Knee when that happened, because I didn't really have a real job. And so it worked out, and it was a tremendous experience to get to really know the natives, Americans, Oglala Sioux, and experience them, and to be, you know, accepted kind of as, you know, part of the community. I went to dances, and I went to a lot of events and got involved in the political side of things that led up to Wounded Knee, and the whole thing itself was really very dramatic, and Unfortunately, after Wounded Knee, the reservation became quite violent, as people probably maybe they know, but there were a lot of drive-by shootings and people were killed. And I was shot at, and a window of my car was shot out one day, and it kind of drove me off the road. And so I decided I had to leave because I had young children. And so that's when I moved to Albuquerque in the next chapter of my life.
How did you even know about the job? And did you know anything about computers prior to taking the job?
No, I didn't know what a computer was. I had no idea. I had a friend who lived in Albuquerque, and so I had visited, and I liked Albuquerque, so we just moved there. And then I started looking for jobs. And at first I wanted to work on the newspaper, but I ended up getting a writing job at MITS, which is the company that ended up inventing the personal computer. And my first job was writing little instruction manuals for how to put together electronic kits. Like you could build your own calculator, your own waveform generator. And I went to the library and I learned what all the components were and how to read resistors and stuff, and was able to figure out how to write a manual for to show people how to assemble a kit, how to solder the parts and what part went where. And I also drew the drawings that would show where all the stuff went. And that was my job at MITS originally. And I stayed there long enough to become like a vice president of marketing. And
one of the people whose name seems to have fallen off the grid for a lot of younger people was the CEO of MITS, Ed Roberts. Could you profile him for us?
Oh, well, Ed was, he's regarded as the father of the personal computer industry. He had the vision that you could take an 8-bit microprocessor chip from Intel and build a general purpose computer around it, and you could sell it cheap initially to hobbyists. And he pulled it off, and we sold a lot of computers, and it sparked that whole revolution and the personal computer revolution. And he was a very interesting guy. He had been an engineer at the Air Force base in Albuquerque. He was one of the people that created the first smart bombs during Vietnam. And he was he was like a hobbyist. He did a lot of hobbies, like he was into ham radios, and he had his own color photography lab and stuff like that. And so he started this little company called MITS originally to make model rockets. And then they went on to make these sort of Heathkit-like kits. And eventually they made this computer. And by the time the computer came out, they were having financial problems. And the company was only about 10 people. And I was one of them. And then when the orders started pouring in, and as we say, all hell broke loose, everybody there worked night and day, and we somehow survived and grew, and Bill Gates and Paul Allen moved to Albuquerque and wrote software for us. Paul was our VP of software, and they started Microsoft in Albuquerque, and MITS and Microsoft were partners until they had a dispute over the ownership of BASIC, and then Microsoft won the dispute, and they went to Seattle, and I left and went to the Bay Area.
For years, I've heard this.
Well, I went to Albuquerque in 72, and I left in 78, I think, something like
that. For years.
So I was there about 5 or 6 years, and the last year I was in Albuquerque was I published a magazine called Personal Computing.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that in a moment or two. For years,
okay.
I've heard this story, and I've believed it, of the popular electronics Les Solomon's 12-year-old daughter Lauren named the first consumer microcomputer, the Altair. Is the story true?
I don't actually know. I know that's what Les Solomon says, and I don't have no reason not to believe him, but other people have said that he just made that up. But I think it's probably true. His daughter was watching an episode of Star Trek, and the Starship Enterprise was going to a planet near the star Altair, and she came up with the name. And it was a really great name, because all the names we had come up with were pretty horrible, and we really did need a name. So I wanted to call it Little Brother.
I knew Les. I was a contributing editor to Popular Electronics, Success Magazine,
yeah.
Computers
yeah.
and Electronics.
Yeah.
And he had a million stories. He supposedly was involved in stealth technology for Israel, and he supposedly had been a spy. And when we got together and we wrote a book, a bunch of us, ahead of his time, another person from that had been with Popular Electronics disputed Les's story, not so much the naming, but he said it was up to him as the editor putting the Altair on the cover, where Les said I would claim credit for that. And at the book party for Digital Deli, Les came storming in hoping that the other fellow would be there, and so he was going to have it out with him, but the fellow wasn't there. And Stan Veed, who was our mutual friend, was trying to calm Les down.
Really?
The usability of the Altair expanded geometrically. As you mentioned, Gates and Allen were the basic interpreters. What was it like working?
That was key. I didn't hear your last question.
What was it like working with them?
With Bill and Paul? Yeah. Wonderful. We were the same, like, generation, the same age. And Roberts was kind of an older guy. In a sense of his – Ed Roberts was like a father figure to me, and he was more of the 50s generation type. You know, whether he wasn't really that much older than us, but he seemed to identify with that. You know, people called him Sir, even his kids. And we were more of the 60s, and we were more freewheeling, and we hung out and had a lot of fun, and went to movies, went to eat at, the Mexican, New Mexico cuisine. We did a lot of fun things. I flew in a little plane with Bill and another Microsoft guy, Rick Weiland, to Comdex in Las Vegas, and a plane they had rented. And it had we had to navigate it by reading a map and identifying water towers and highways and stuff along the way. And on the way back, Bill had been up all night gambling, shooting craps. And so he was asleep with his coat over his head, and I was a designated navigator. And, you know, fly down a little bit lower, I think that's the water tower.
Oh, God.
Rushville, Nebraska, let's see, you know. And somehow we got back.
Did they or you ever think that the Microsoft with a hyphen, for the audience, the firm's name was originally spelled MICRO-soft, would ever evolve into the Microsoft it became?
Yeah, it was two words. And I designed their first logo, so I know. And I designed their first business cards and letterhead. Paul worked with me on that, and I found these. I did it with what was called press type. You remember press type?
Oh yeah,
yeah. You know, I had this whole book of press type, and we picked one that he liked, and I put it together with that.
Now,
so it's Microsoft.
Right. Both of them have told the story that when they founded the company, that they knew they needed a goal, and that their goal was to have a computer running Microsoft software in every home and office. And, of course, there weren't any computers. There wasn't even the product yet. Did Did they really have
well,
that
vision?
Well,
I think they added the word "and office" maybe later.
Okay.
I think it was a computer in every home was really the vision. You know, they do a little editing looking backwards, I think.
But
God
did they
knows
have
I
that vision?
Them
and
of that.
And
what
did
you say?
Expect? Did they have that vision? And did you expect
yeah.
it to ever happen?
Hell yeah, they did. And that's Bill was. They had a vision. They were driven. They stayed up all night. They worked hard. They absolutely had a vision about computers being liberated from the computer priesthood and being accessible, and that lots of people would want to use computers and find uses for them depending on the software. And the software was the key. Without good software, you had to create software so people could use computers without understanding how to program them themselves. And they understood that absolutely.
And having a stored program is just like the ENIAC. People originally had to, and that's the first working electronic computer for the audience.
Yeah. Well, you know, did you know Ted Nelson, by the way?
Yeah. Yes, I do.
Yeah, he wrote the book Computer Lib, and he had the vision, too.
Yeah.
I mean, they weren't the only ones.
And Jobs had a vision, obviously.
Yeah, Jobs definitely had a vision.
But
Jobs had a vision of, like, this should really be a consumer, you know, people, it should really be a mass marketed. He was the first one to kind of figure that out. You know, he made the Apple, even the Apple II for its day, it would look, you know, really spiffy instead of just a metal box with buttons and switches, you know, it's nice.
Well, the ENIAC, you had to also program by throwing switches. It was only later that the stored program came along, and it was really the same progression that you made on the Altair from people having to know what they were doing to be able to load a program into it. And that was a...
Yeah. Yeah,
and then looking back, you mentioned Jobs, or I mentioned Jobs. To us, or to the public now, it's no big deal to put a computer into a case. It was a big deal, and why would any hobbyist need a case, you know? But,
yeah.
You mentioned that you grew with the company, too, from a tech writer who first didn't know anything about the vice president of marketing who had marketing experience. What was it for you at a relatively young age to develop that rapidly?
Oh, that was great. I think that my earlier work in the newspaper office had a lot to do with that because I learned how to learn and I learned how to figure out stuff for myself. So, you know, the first thing that happened at MITS was the advertising manager that got – MITS did all its own advertising, and the guy who did all that left the company. And so, you know, Roberts just asked me if I could do it, and I said yes. And so I went out, and I got a big stack of the publication Advertising Age, and I started studying that. And I just kind of figured out what a good ad would look like, and I figured out how you contact a magazine and how you place an ad. And I started doing their ads, and they had a reputation for having really good advertising. So I did that, and then I learned about marketing, and I was involved with helping them build the stores and get the product out. And, you know, I created the first convention for personal computer enthusiasts, the World Altair Computer Convention. In Albuquerque, we had people from all over the world actually came to it. And it was the first time that all those hobbyists and enthusiasts had actually gotten together and met each other. And the first time you could see all the exciting products and stuff that were available. Bill was our keynote speaker. And that was an exciting time, too, because they were pretty pissed off at him.
Yeah, tell us about the famous Gates letter to hackers and your role in that.
Yeah, well, what happened, it started with Ed Roberts, who decided that it'd be a really cool idea to charge people a lot more money to buy BASIC if they didn't also buy an Altair. So if you bought an MSI computer or a processor tech computer and you wanted BASIC, you had to pay three times as much. You had to pay like $700 or something instead of $200, roughly. And, of course, the hobbyists found that very offensive, so they just stole the copies. And it was easy to copy. It was on paper punch tape, and they could just get a tape and make copies and pass it around at the club meetings, homebrew computer club. They would pass it around. And, of course, this kind of put a damper in Bill Gates's plans because he was depending on royalties from Microsoft to build his company and to be able to do other software projects. And this wasn't materializing. And so he wrote an open letter to hobbyists. And in that letter, he said that they were all, he said, you know, you are all thieves. Because you steal this. And he explained why it was a bad idea to steal software. And he brought the letter to me, and I sent it out to all the hobbyist publications, like Byte Magazine. Plus, we had our own computer notes. I put it in there. I sent it to our mailing list. I got it published in, you know, Popular Electronics and a whole bunch of different places. And other, you know, there were newsletters that some of these computer hobbyists had, and created a firestorm. And one group, the Southern California Computer Society, which was a pretty big club of about 4,000 people, they threatened to file a lawsuit against Gates and MITS for defamation, because basically they weren't all thieves, just some of them, something like that. And so at the World Altair Computer Convention, Gates had to kind of defend himself. And he did a good job. He did a good job, but he was on the hot seat. And Roberts was pissed off at him. And that was my fault. Because Roberts was pissed off because the letter was on MIT's letterhead. But that was my doing, so, you know, it wasn't his fault so much.
I understand anyway, that even that after the fallout between Gates and Roberts, that they didn't talk for years, but when Roberts, after going to medical school and becoming a doctor, was terminally ill, that Gates came to visit him, and they made up.
Yeah. Well, he did come. That was very nice of Bill. He's, you know, that was incredible, really. That was a great thing. But Roberts was very bitter. He always liked Paul, if I remember talking to Ed. He would say things like, Paul was really the one with the brains. He was the smart guy. You know, Paul is all really Paul. You know, Bill was just whatever he would say about Bill. It wouldn't be very nice. Like Bill was stupid or something.
Yeah.
I imagine anyone thinking Bill Gates is stupid.
I haven't known him as long as you have, but I remember being at one of the early Rosen conferences, and people were introducing me to him. And it was interesting. The venture capitalists were all over like flies. And Bill, young Bill at the time, was very good with them, but he kept them away. You know, he handled them well. He didn't him off, but he also didn't let any get too close to him. And I've written about it. I've known, like, I thought Jobs was a visionary. The early guys, Wozniak and the like, they were masterful technicians. A friend of mine, Morgan Stanley, Ben Rosen, was a super big man. And Gates was the only one that I knew that was all of the above. Did he put them all together, you know?
All of that, plus you have a knack for business, you know.
What led to the demise of MITS?
Well, first of all, they losing control over Microsoft BASIC, which is really, if you look back, that was their biggest asset. they had an agreement with Microsoft, with Bill, that they would jointly go out and license BASIC to other manufacturers, and they would share in the royalties. And MITS didn't want to do that. MITS reneged. They didn't want to license BASIC to other people. And so Bill took them to court. It was like an arbitration because they it was in the contract that they would do that. And as a result of the arbitration, Microsoft won all rights to BASIC and left MITS out in the cold. And MITS was, Roberts got tired of it all, I guess, and he sold the company to a larger company called Pertec. And it just kind of disappeared inside of Pertec. They really had no clue. And, you know, things had shifted from Albuquerque to the San Francisco Bay Area. Everything that was important was happening out there, not so much in Albuquerque. And then when Microsoft moved to Seattle and, you know, I moved to San Francisco, it was all over. There was no one left.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about it until right now when we were just talking about it, the licensing versus the ownership. That was really a forerunner of Microsoft's deal with IBM, that IBM let them have the right to license other people.
Yeah. It was. You know, Bill was very smart about that. And, yeah, he did it in a much bigger way with IBM.
What brought you to San Francisco?
Well, I had wanted to, you know, still be part of the computer revolution. It wasn't really happening in Albuquerque. And so I moved to San Francisco. I wrote a book about personal computing, and I got various freelance jobs. I wrote some of the early documentation for VisiCalc. I did marketing jobs for Microsoft. I got a job working at a company called GRT that did computer games on cassette tapes. And I wrote manuals for them. I did marketing things for them. And, you know, I just did all these different kinds of things. I wound up working with Adam Osborne at his book publishing company, but it was right during the time when he was launching his computer company. So I experienced all of that with Adam, became great friends with him. And when I left Osborne McGraw-Hill, I started PC Magazine. So, you know.
It's funny when you how all this hangs together. You mentioned writing a manual for VisiCalc. We were early in the game. Barbara and I were early in the game. We had an Apple II before VisiCalc, and then when Ben Rosen wrote about it, we were early in VisiCalc. And I'd been an English major in college, but I hadn't written. I'd always planned to write. And Popular Computing asked Dan Bricklin to write an article about uses for VisiCalc. So Bricklin said that wasn't what they did, but he recommended that they talk to Barbara McMullen. So Barbara wrote the article for Popular Computing, and we both started writing. And then over the years, I became the principal writer, and she'd edit my stuff. But it was all because of VisiCalc and Bricklin that we got into something that we've been doing for over 40 years. And the other thing, you mentioned Adam. I wrote a review of the spreadsheet that he was selling in the paperback software. For InfoWorld, and I really trashed it. It was paperback. It was paperback spreadsheet doesn't or something like that. And there was some editing done to it that made it even worse. So Adam stormed into to their office, and he said, "This is terrible, and all this, and this is awful." And so they called me. They were very upset, and that eventually led to us having a parting of the ways. But I got very upset, so I sent my original article to Bricklin. I said, "Is there anything wrong with this?" Now, he really didn't want to get involved with Adam, but he said, "No, it's absolutely correct." So I called Adam, and I first talked to his guy in charge of software, and I sent him a copy of the article, and he agreed with it. They didn't have any replication in it. They didn't have something in it that made it just just non-usable. So I called Adam, and I said, look, I talked to this fellow, and I can send you the original article. There's nothing wrong, but it was edited to make it sound worse. If you want me to call InfoWorld and make a big deal to write a public statement. And he said, nah, it's too late. It's all over. Danny was right, you know. So I felt bad about that it got trashed even more than I had trashed it. But he was an interesting guy. Do you know the story?
Yeah.
Do you know the story of his parents, don't you?
They were missionaries in India.
No, they were anti-missionaries.
That's
they were
right.
anti-missionaries.
Sorry, I got that confused. Yes, anti-missionaries.
Yeah, they went to convert the people back to what they should have been before they were converted, which I thought
was
interesting.
Right, exactly. Yeah, well, he ended up dying in India.
Yeah. Yeah, he was. He had done so well with the writing, and he was so well respected. And then with the problems that he had with the computer and with the developers and with the and with so many different people, it kind of tarnished his reputation. It was unfortunate.
It is unfortunate because I thought he was a great man.
Tell us about the origin of PC Magazine.
The story of PC Magazine. Well, I was at my desk at Osborne McGraw-Hill, Adam's book publishing company, when I got a call from Eddie Curry one day. And Eddie had been someone I knew back in Albuquerque at ITS. And he said, I'm working for this guy who wants to start a magazine, and we've been looking for you. And I said, well, it was an inopportune time, so I said, well, I'll call you back. I hung up. But when I called him back, he had was working with a person named Tony Gold, who had a software company in New York, and they wanted to start a magazine, and the idea was kind of a software magazine. So I flew back to New York, and I met them, and we had a whole series of conversations about starting a magazine. And kind of in the middle of that entire process, IBM announced the personal computer, and I think the three of us kind of had the same idea at the same time because we were on the phone. I mean, I was jumping up and down with excitement, and they were excited about the idea that, hey, why don't we start a magazine for this new IBM computer? And while I was at the book publishing company, I had sort of saw this phenomenon where machine-specific books outsold general books. So if you had a book about how to program in BASIC, it would not sell as well as a book how to program in BASIC on an Apple computer. So if it's
right.
specific to a machine, the sales were way greater. And so it seemed like that might be true with a magazine, especially if the computer was from IBM, and especially if it was a big success. So we kind of came up with the idea, and I found a I had an old friend named Jim Evelyn, and he became my partner, and he was the editor, and another friend, Cheryl Woodard, became the marketing person, and my wife, who was a prize-winning photographer, became the designer. You know, she didn't know anything about magazine design, but she knew about design, so that's kind of how a lot of things happen in this world. And so Tony put in some money, and I first thing I did is go up to Seattle, and I interviewed Bill Gates and discovered that he had been very, very much involved in the whole process of designing the IBM computer and developing it and working with the people at IBM, and the software was from Microsoft. And so that made me feel like it was going to be a success. And so the interview I did, and then we got a computer, and we took it apart, and we took a lot of photographs, and we, you know, Taking the Measure was our first cover story about the IBM computer. And we wrote a very critical review of the first software for the IBM computer called Easy Writer. And the title of our review was Not So Easy Writer. And
John
that was
Draper.
By Andrew Fluelman. Yeah.
Yeah, Draper had done that for the Apple II, and it was It was the first decent word processor, but on the Apple II, you only had 40 columns. Then he always blamed the awful easy writers for the IBM. I'm the company that he worked for, information somebody or other, that made him make changes.
Yeah.
They blamed him, said he never made any changes. They went back and forth.
Yeah, they were probably all stoned.
Well, if you remember,
they thought they were doing it, but they weren't actually doing it.
If you remember, what IBM did was they were in competition, really, they thought, with Apple. And speaking of people who were in Boca, they only wanted a 64K machine because what Apple had. And if you to load the machine with the original memory cards that IBM had, all the way up to what they thought was the Mac 512, you couldn't put a monitor card in. And they went out to the people that had the top-selling software for the Apple II to VisiCalc or to VisiCorp and to and for Easy Rider. And they made the bad choice with Easy Rider.
Yeah. Anyway, the magazine came out, and one of the great things that happened was sort of amazing is Byte Magazine, which was by far the dominant publication at that time. You remember they had 500-600 page issues. They ran a huge cover story. The new IBM personal computer that everybody had to buy, and they dissected the machine and everything about it. And in that article, they said, there's even a new magazine for the computer called PC Magazine, and they put the address and the subscription price in the article.
Wow. I don't remember that.
And we got hundreds, maybe thousands, of cards. I started the magazine in the house that my wife and I had in Golden Gate Park, San Francisco, the house she was renting. And we got hundreds of mail. It came in mail bags, and every envelope we would open, there would be a check in it. And so that really gave us a nice boost. And the second issue of PC Magazine was like 400 pages because there was just this boom of products that were developed for the IBM PC. And at the time, there was no internet. It was too expensive to advertise on TV. There wasn't really cable TV so much. And so the magazine was the primary place for people to advertise their products and to reach the market. And it just boomed. And after that, a bunch of publishers became very interested in buying the magazine, and Tony Gold didn't really have the capital that we needed to really grow the magazine the way it needed to be grown. We couldn't afford to put it on the newsstand, and we did well, but we really needed to up the game. It was necessary. We had 5 or 6 little office spaces on a street called Irving Street in San Francisco, and we decided that we would sell the magazine. And we went out and we had all kinds of people. CBS was one, IDG definitely, Ziff Davis, Pinwell Publishing, ABC Publishing, lots of publishers were interested in PC Magazine. And just to make this story a little bit short, Tony Gold sold it to Ziff Davis without telling us, and we didn't like Ziff Davis that much, and we weren't getting along with Tony that well. And so we all quit and went to Pat McGovern, and he funded us, and we started PC World Magazine. So that's why there were two.
End of the story. Tony had owned a Lifeboat that was a software developer for Unix, and Eddie Curry was software manager. And
right.
I remember I'd to the Apple user group because if you remember, Microsoft had developed the CBM card for the the Apple II. And
yeah, right.
I remember when they sold it out from Monday, and it's two things that relate to that I thought were interesting. Number one, I interviewed Bill McCrone on the radio show, he told me when Ziff hired him to work on a PC after the sale, he was told that the entire original staff had quit and that he better find a work at a magazine. And I was surprised then that so soon after the sale that you could found Peace World. I remember at the time that it seemed to come so soon that I couldn't believe that there was no non-compete clause in the terms of sale. Wasn't there any?
There was no agreement with me and Ziff Davis. The agreement was with Tony. And they tried to get an injunction to prevent the publishing of PC World magazine.
Okay.
And we worked night and day. We had people sleeping on cots. And our lawyers told us if we could get the first issue out before the hearing date or by the hearing date, that no judge in America was going to pull magazines off a newsstand. And we got the first issue of PC World out the day of the hearing.
Oh, wow.
So there was no way a judge was going to issue an injunction because it would cause damages. And so that lawsuit then became, for a while, the largest civil lawsuit in California. And it went on for several years and was finally settled. I settled with Bill Ziff, and then eventually IDG and Ziff Davis settled. But it was a massive lawsuit, and the two magazines were very fiercely competitive, and we both did extremely well.
Yeah, PC PC became such the cash cow for Ziff that it really raised the bar for the publications, and it really put the publication that I was on the masthead for, computers and electronics, out of business because it was not the cash cow. So I wrote for PC for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, those magazines were huge. And then we started Macworld, and it was pretty huge, too. So we had, you know, one magazine, PC World, would be 500 or 600 pages, and Macworld was over 400 pages. And every month, you know, it was amazing.
You also,
those were good times.
Macworld, you also went into the computer show business with Macworld Expo. How did that happen?
Well, I had done shows before, beginning, remember the World Altair Computer Convention?
Yeah, right.
And then when I had Personal Computing Magazine, I did a Personal Computing Convention. So I knew that those two things had a lot of synergy because, you know, the people who read the magazine or become the attendees of the show, the advertisers become the exhibitors. And so I came up, I said, we should do this Macworld Expo, and we put it together at Moscone Center. The first one, we shared the ground floor of Moscone Center with a boat show. We had about 10,000 people, but it was a very big deal for us and especially for Apple because it brought together the developers and the enthusiasts in one, you know, big place like a party, and it really galvanized them and helped them feel like we are not alone, you know, because there was a lot of concern about the Macintosh because after it came out, it seemed like the development of it was going very slowly, and there was a need for more memory, a need for a hard drive, a need for more software, a need for this and that, and it was kind of stalling. So the Macworld Expo kind of reignited that, and for which John Sculley was very grateful. Maybe Steve was, but he was kind of preoccupied with Tina and other things. Anyway, that's where that came from. And Macworld Expo became a gigantic show. It's still happening, but it's not as big as it once was. But it was the biggest convention in San Francisco.
That's what you just mentioned, that I hadn't realized you're in with Personal Computer Magazine. Was that before Hayden had it, or was it while Hayden?
Before, yeah. Yeah, I started with a little company called Benwell. They were in Boston, and they were a kind of a technology publishing company. And they funded it, and I did everything in Albuquerque. And then they wanted to move the magazine back to Boston, and I wanted to go to the West Coast because I could see that everything in personal computing was happening in, you know, in California and Seattle. So I went west, and they took the magazine, and they eventually sold it to Hayden.
Yeah, that was – I also wrote for them. The fellow named Jules Gilbert was a member of the Apple User Group. I was the president of it in New York. And he was the software editor, or he was the editor. So he put me in touch with the Hayden president, who was a very nice man whose name escaped me completely. But after he sold Hayden, he went into religious publishing. He was a very committed Roman Catholic, and he went into into spending money in charity and everything. A very nice man.
That's good.
Tell us about BioWorld. That was a bit of a departure for you.
I got kind of interested in biotech as a result of a conversation with Bill Gates. I've had dinner with him. We were in Michigan at Ann Arbor. There was a big user group there, and we were both speaking, and afterwards we had dinner. And I asked him about DNA, and he explained that it was like software, and he was very interested in DNA. And he said that if he hadn't got into the computer business, he would have been a scientist, and that he was investing in some biotech company. So I got really kind of interested in that, and I had a friend who worked at Genentech, and he had been at Apple, but he was now at Genentech, and he got me into the library at Genentech. I went there, and I spent a couple, 3 or 4 days there looking at all these technical journals and books about biotechnology, some of which I could kind of decipher, but a lot of which I really did not understand. But, you know, there wasn't much stopping me in those days. So I had my contract with IDG was over, and I had some resources, and so I started a company to publish BioWorld and came up with the idea of how to deliver it as a fax. I wanted to create a daily publication for biotech executives, like a business publication, a Wall Street Journal, and deliver it daily. There was this pre-internet, so I hired an engineer, and we built our own proprietary fax blaster, which is basically a computer linked to a fax machine with software, so that we could send out, we ended up sending out as many as like 1,200 copies of a 10 or 12 page fax every night. We put the paper to bed about 6 o'clock, start up the fax machine, and it would go all night long. We delivered first to customers on the East Coast and then coming to the West. And we charged $900 for a subscription to BioWorld. And it did quite well enough that I, after a few years, I sold it to a company down in Georgia, American Health Publishing, I think it's called. Or they're still publishing it, only it's an internet-based publication. It's not sent by fax anymore. But that was very, very exciting. I learned a lot. I was probably way too early in the biotech business. I got a bunch of people from the industry together. I had them come to my house for a Sunday afternoon little soiree thing. And they had a big conversation where I learned that most of them didn't identify with the biotech industry. They said, there's no such thing as a biotech industry, we're just a subset of pharmaceuticals. And I was like, Jesus Christ, I'm making a publication for these guys and they don't even know they exist. So I was kind of early. But it was quite a good experience. And I did that. After that is when I got involved with New Media Magazine and then Upside.
Yeah, with Upside, what brought on that move and what was the focus of Upside?
Upside was a magazine that focused on investments and startups.
it was the intersection of the investment community and the technology community. Our readers tended to be venture capitalists, angel investors, and heads of tech companies, executives in tech companies. It was a controlled circulation, so you had to be in one of those categories to get the magazine. And I had invested a little money in it and was on the board. And the two founders had a kind of a falling out, and they left, and there was a vacuum, and it ran, kind of puttered along for a while, and then at a certain point, I decided I would like to try to step in and see what I could do with it. So that happened. And it grew like crazy. It was wonderful while it lasted.
I remember that. For your efforts in journalism, you were honored as the recipient of the only Lifetime Achievement Award from Computer Press Association. Another disclaimer, Barbara and I used to edit the CPA newsletter. You must have been pleased with that award when you think of the many
I
other members.
I was thrilled, and I'm still thrilled about it. I'm very proud of it. It was great. You know, it was really terrific. I felt like, you know, I had accomplished something, and that all those magazines and all this stuff, the writing, was very important and key to the – there wouldn't be a personal computer. And if there wasn't a personal computer, there wouldn't be all these other things. And you had to have a voice out there to explain to people why they should want one, how they should use it, what it was for, where the new things are, where to get one, where to go for help, you know, all, you know, and also where to advertise. So that was the vehicle for spreading the message and for making it all happen. And to have played a part in that was really a great thing. Met a lot of really interesting people, got to do a lot of traveling, you know. It was not what I started out to do, and I'm not really into it that much these days, but for the time, it was great.
One of the officers of it, or one of the people who got us into taking the newsletter was Wendy Woods, who was my boss with Newsbytes when I was a New York editor for that. The Upside was very successful until the early 2000s, then things fell apart. You also had some personal tragedy at that time. Tell us whatever you're comfortable with about that period.
Well, first of all, the magazine was doing extremely well, and we had the Red Herring was a competitor, and Industry Standard was a competitor, and all three of the publications were based in San Francisco, all doing incredibly well. But when the bottom fell out of the dot-com market, you know, suddenly we, from one month to the next, we lost about 50% of our advertisers. It was that sudden. And we tried to retrench, and I'm sure the other publications tried to retrench, but we couldn't retrench fast enough. It kept getting worse and worse. And, you know, there just wasn't, the business just wasn't there overnight. It was like incredible. The bubble burst in a big way. And eventually we had an investment bank that had invested in helping grow Upside. They took over the publication, and I don't know why they bothered, but they kind of kept it going for a little while, and then it went out of business. So that was sad. And then at that, my son was had been at USC in film school, and after film school, he was casting about for stuff to do. And he had done some things, but I hired him to run the Upside online business, and he did that extremely well. We had Upside Today was an online site, and we were very competitive with Red Herring and Industry Standard, even though we were much smaller staff. And we started a daily online radio called Upside Financial, which followed the stock markets, and we had an office in New York. And he went to New York, and he died. He fell asleep in the Waldorf Astoria room and didn't wake up. He was taking some different drugs and drinking, and it just, he was in the fast lane, you know.
And unfortunately, a lot of the media picked up on that, and they kind of turned him into the poster boy for the underbelly of the dot-com world. You know, he was. I tried to keep some of this, you know, somewhat out, protect his grandparents and his uncles from what had happened. And they knew he died, but, you know, I didn't want them to know a lot of the details. And
right.
One morning, it was on the front page of the Sunday Los Angeles Times. Like, so that was the end of that.
That's very sad.
Very, very tragic. And, you know, we're still getting over it.
My son is, he was NYU film school. And
yeah.
USC and NYU are considered the best film schools in the country. And he's been a TV writer for years. He lives outside
Fantastic.
Of Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So he's
I love USC. I remember so vividly when they had parent orientation day. My son was going to USC. It was very exciting. I went down there with all their parents. And what do you think was the very first thing they took all of us parents to see on that campus?
What?
The first thing we saw was Simpson's Heisman Trophy, O.J. Simpson's Heisman Trophy.
I almost sent the football field. Yeah, but the,
of all the things they could be proud of at USC, that was the number one thing.
Well, just as Penn State was a school of the linebackers and Notre Dame and Miami of the quarterbacks, USC was the school of the running backs.
The running backs.
Yeah.
O.J. Simpson was so famous, and he was doing the Hertz commercials and jumping over the luggage and stuff. He was still.
It's interesting that if I've talked to advertising people and I've read about this, that he was the best possible figure for both them and for Tropicana, because you remember the product. So many of these innovative ads, you say, oh, yeah, she was selling paper towels, but you don't know what the paper towels were. Or you saw all
exactly.
those athletes sitting around drinking beer, but you weren't sure if it was Miller's or Budweiser, you know? but he kept the product of visibility. In the last decade, you mentioned that you're not as involved with computer publication anymore. You've been very involved in both community computer-related projects and health-related issues, including the founding of the Bunnell Wellness Network. Tell us about these activities.
I have an avid interest in health and wellness and medicine, and have kind of developed in that area. I've written a couple books and dozens of articles and been at lots of conferences, and I'm still developing ideas in that area. I'm trying to learn how to write. I would like to write more, you know, nonfiction and even maybe novels or things like that. You know, I'm trying to really advance my writing skills, and that was my ambition when all this stuff started with the computers. What I wanted to be was a writer, and I'm learning more about the craft of writing and developing that and finding things to do. I did a lot of social media marketing for a while, not so much now, but in the very early days with Twitter and Facebook, I got interested in that and did marketing projects for other, you know, for doctors and health related professionals and organizations. And even did a whole bunch of marketing for a chain of restaurants, you know, and I like to keep very active with my mind and with developing my skills, and I like staying at home. I don't really want to go to an office again ever, particularly. So I work out of my house, and things happen. I find stuff to do and ways to make a little money here and there to augment stuff. And we have a granddaughter living with us who's 19, and I have another granddaughter who's 16, and we're supporting them and helping them. You know, our granddaughters go to school, and we're trying to maintain our lives, and it's fun and fascinating. I always meet new people and interesting things, and I'm not I don't feel like I'm missing out on much in the tech world. I think I could plop myself back into it if I wanted to, and I'm not sure I want to, but I'm kind of learning how to also just be a little bit mellower person, you know, take a little time out to enjoy the view, as they say on The View, a show my wife watches all the time.
The SDS person has turned into a mellow person.
Well, maybe so, but, you know, I'm just as, you know, I'm very much care, at least, about the world and about, you know, I think, let me tell you something. I don't understand, I can't get my head around why the Republicans are so opposed to increasing the minimum wage. It does make no sense to me. If I had my way, I would increase it to $20 an hour. What would happen? All these people would have more money in their pocket. They would go shopping. They would go to restaurants. They would spend the money. They're not going to be saving it. They're going to be spending it. The economy would boom. It's like, give me a break. If you pay people such little money, they don't have any pocket change. Our economy is consumer-driven more than anything else. Whenever, you know, like the last quarter, there was a bit of a downturn in economics because of all the bad weather, people weren't able to go out shopping. So the entire American economy went down 2%. I mean, that should tell you something. So, you know, the people at Walmart, if their workers made $15 an hour, they might be able to shop and buy more stuff at Walmart.
There's more than that going on, though. The Walmart.
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot more.
The Walmart
going on, but that's
employees.
One
many Walmart employees are on food stamps. So the taxpayers are subsidizing Walmart, keeping the prices low.
It's outrageous. Walmart was telling them how to get food stamps.
The internal
literature. They're ripping this off. These big, you know, we've gotten to be, the concentration of wealth is just a huge issue. It makes no sense. It's like, and it's being, technology is unfortunately playing a big role in that because it's the ability
it's more
to concentrate
than a big role.
Wealth is, you know.
I've been writing for years. I'm in my 115th column on something I call Creative Disruption, where technology changes everything. And we don't see it till all of a sudden that we notice that there's no music stores in the mall, or there's no film processing stores, or the guy who lived next door to us was a senior vice president to Kodak and selling his house. But the whole middle class is being pushed out, and the high tech creates a small amount of great new jobs while getting rid of a whole lot of middle-class jobs, and nobody seems to care.
I know,
and
it's wrong. And who's going to buy all this shit in the future? There's, you know, you need to have more people with more spending money to really sustain the economy. There's no way around that. And so it's very short-sighted, that's what I think. The people that are, you know, in favor of continuing along the merry path are fools. They're fools.
Well, they aren't going to reap the problems. The problems are going to be with your granddaughter's age, where they're
absolutely. Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah. So there's a lot to care about in the world. There's no shortage of issues and
reasons to be involved. And so, you know, I'm not the kind of person that's going to retire to a golf course someday.
You mentioned that you've been doing writing and trying to enhance your skills. Well, obviously you have great skills for the years of journalism. I've been writing for, well, I guess, 40 years in about technology, and I was an English major in school. I had never, after graduation, never mind written a poem, but read a poem. And about 6 years ago, I happened to pick up the book by San Francisco writer, Charles Bukowski, because the title...
I love Charles Bukowski.
Well, the title attracted me, and I said, hey, I could do this. So now I have a book of 100 poems, 110 poems up on Amazon, and I've written the novel, and I wish I could have more time to do that, you know?
Yeah.
What about computers than you? Is that still there? Is it still a computer learning center?
No, it's not there anymore.
Okay.
I should mention the Andrew Flugelman Foundation, which I run.
Oh, okay.
You know, Andrew was the editor of PC World and then Macworld magazines. So I was like the publisher and he was the editor. We were partners. And in 1986, he jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge. And it was very, very tragic. He was a young man. He'd just been married. And he was very well-liked. He had done well in software as well as writing. And he actually created the concept of shareware. He pioneered that. And I remember there's a film of him speaking at a hackers conference where he says, "I'm Andrew Flugelman, and I've made quite a bit of money giving software away." So we started, when after he died, we raised a little money and we started a foundation for him. And we did some investing. Then when I left PC World, nothing happened with that foundation. And about 3 years ago, the people at Tides who were managing the money approached me and said, "Hey, there's still some money there." And so what we do is every year we identify a small group of students who are struggling with finances and struggling with a hard life. You know, they usually come a lot of times single parent families, kids that are growing up in bad neighborhoods, but somehow in spite of all the obstacles they're excelling in high school and they've graduated with good grades and they're going to college, they've got a scholarship to college. And so we identify them by having them write essays, and we give them a Macintosh computer for college and some training. And we do that every year. So I pretty much run through the funds that are there, so I'm going to need to call out to all my old computer friends to help me put together some more funding for this. And it's a great thing because a lot of kids who are in that situation, they don't have a laptop. They don't have the resources to really buy one. They end up, you know, going to the library to borrow the computers. And it really is a terrific gift to them. So that's the one charitable thing that I'm very involved with. It's the Andrew Flugelman Foundation.
That's great. I don't know if you ever went to any of the computer freedom and privacy conferences, but I was the first person to run the scholarship committee. And what we did was that we took essays from people, and on they hope to get out of the conference. And conferences have been in San Francisco and in Chicago and in Washington. They're up to the 26th. Warren was the original. The original founder of it, really, and these people wrote wonderful essays about what they hoped to get out of the conference and what they would bring back to their communities, and the spirit of the young folks was tremendous. John Gilmore was one of the early funders of it, but then when the when we accepted money for the conference from the government. He said that he still wanted the scholarships to go on, but if we're going to take government money, he's very libertarian. He was going to bow out of that.
Yeah,
it's payback time. I mean, I'm teaching at SUNY Purchase, and we've gotten a lot out of this industry, and it is payback time, and you hope that you can make some changes so the industry doesn't take all of the next generations down the tubes and have them working in McDonald's, you know?
Yeah, really.
So other than the foundation, what's in the future for David Bunnell? You've had a wide and varied career. What's next?
I'm working on a concept for a book that's related to health and technology. And I'm working on a project to write about the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. So I have those two things actively happening. So, and, you know, you never know what might just fall into my lap here and there. It happens.
You mentioned health technologies. There's an article in today's New York Times in the business section about the University of Pittsburgh's, it's either the hospital center or the whatever, but it's a consortium of hospitals, and they have their own insurance company. And to what they're going to be doing is data mining. So if you're an insurance holder with them, they're going to try to find out your habits and where you shop and where you eat and things like this. And the idea is to predict your possible health. Now, it sounds, and according to the Times article, they aren't telling the policyholders this. So, for instance, if you spend hundreds of dollars a month at the local liquor store, then they might say, well, he's probably got a drinking problem, and they might downsize you, but you might be buying for your alcoholic grandmother who you're keeping alive, you know? And it sounds kind of creepy, but I don't know. What do you think about things like that?
Well, my whole take on healthcare is that the solutions aren't going to come from the hospitals or the medical establishment. That we are becoming a healthier nation already. It's happening, but it's coming from the ground up. It's coming from people getting wise to the things that will make them healthier and live longer. It's coming from some radical doctors who are getting the word out about health and vitamins and exercise. And it's coming from technology pioneers who are creating ways, new products, and coming out of things like a quantified self movement, where people are keeping track of biometrics and learning things from keeping track. It's coming from networks of people who have cancer and are talking to each other and learning from each other. It's coming from all these different areas. It's all over the place. And it's really a groundswell, a revolution that is going to result and is resulting in us having a healthier country. And all of the stats that these organizations like the American Heart Association and Alzheimer's Association and groups like that put out about, you know, how many people are going to have dementia in the year 2040 and stuff, it's all bullshit. It ain't going to happen because people are getting wise, and we're going to figure out, and we are figuring out, how to prevent diseases and how to be healthier. And it's happening. It's just not being recognized, at least not on the scale that I think it's happening. So if you want to know what's happening in healthcare, go to health conference, or, you know, you're not going to find out by going to the AMA convention. That's my theory.
I hope you're right.
I think it's there's a lot of really wonderful things going on. It's just that
the totality of it all will be huge, but it hasn't been recognized yet.
We've covered a lot of bases in exploring your interesting productive. What else might you like the audience to know about David Bunnell?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a perfect human being. I have my flaws. I'm not always, I'm lazy sometimes. I like to lie around and watch sports on the TV. Some nights I drink too much beer. I'm not always nice to people like I should be. But I mean well, and I'm learning to be very comfortable in my own skin. I think everyone should be that way. I could be, you know, I don't mind being alone when I am alone. I like the idea that you just have this incredible thing called a brain and that you can follow your interests and find interesting things and experience stuff, and it's never ending. It's an amazing thing, and if you learn to just kind of go with the flow, you can be pretty happy, and you can have a kind of ever-expanding life of experiences and knowledge, and it's kind of great. That's how I feel about it.
Our brain was the ultimate hypercard, if you remember that, where we could link from things to things, jump all over the place. Yeah.
Yeah, well, and if you use it or lose it, you know. I mean, if you don't want to have short-term memory loss and you don't want to develop dementia, you know, I think that really one of the keys is to really make active use of what you have. And the other one is probably to take omega-3.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
It's been a real pleasure,
David. This was fun. Okay.
And in the words of the Mets radio announcer, Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in a book. Tune in next week for my conversation with computer pioneer and as a pundit and also angel investor and cosmonaut. And that's the story in itself, Esther Dyson. And until then, as they used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, Silver. Whoa. Easy, big guy.